As we explore history on this show, I'm noticing more and more that the left used to be a lot stronger than it is now. That's why we got a New Deal before, and why we don't have any chance of getting a New Deal right now as things stand. Post-World War II, we had a Communist Party, we had active unions, we had a couple of socialist parties, and we could actually scare people then. The plutocrats were afraid enough that they bargained with FDR, and FDR, bless his heart, hoodwinked us into thinking we could solve our problems at the ballot box through the duopoly, through the two corporate parties, rather than through continual and ever-vigilant militancy. Like it or not, if you look back at the history, you can see that what we had then was militancy. Frederick Douglass was right. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. If there is no struggle, there is no progress. So that brings me to a couple of articles by left-wingers about guns. The first is featured in lots of places, but I think it first came out on Vox. It's by Kim Kelly, titled, "I'm a left-wing anarchist. Guns aren't just for right-wingers. The long-forgotten history of pro-gun left-wing groups." Right-wingers have held an unearned monopoly on gun culture for too long. Whether it's in the halls of legislative power or in the comments under gun bunny photos on Instagram, there is a prevailing narrative that pegs guns and armed self-defense exclusively to Republicans, racist libertarians, and other generally constitution-obsessed weirdos. It maintains that those on the left want to take away everyone's guns and swathe the entire country in bubble wrap. But I'm an anarchist, and I call bullshit. I'm of the firm opinion that it's time to not only arm the left, but challenge the narrative that all leftists are anti-gun. Many are, and that's a position I can understand and respect, but there is also a long history of armed community self-defense among the radical left that is often glossed over or forgotten entirely in favor of the Fox News-friendly narrative that all liberals hate guns. That's simply not the case. Though, as history has proven, the only thing that scares the reactionary right more than the idea of losing their guns is the thought of us having them. I grew up with guns, and my familiarity with them is a big part of why I view things the way I do. My family hunts for sustenance, and gun safety was taught to me before I was tall enough to see over my dad's workbench. I can understand why people who weren't raised around them would view firearms with fear and loathing, but for me, a gun in the hands of someone I trust is a comforting sight because I know the power it holds. When I was in Charlottesville, Virginia, protesting the Unite the Right rally in 2017, the only time I truly felt safe was when members of Redneck Revolt, a working-class anti-fascist, anti-racist armed community defense group, showed up open carrying and secured the park where a number of us were gathered. The police may have stood by and done nothing as a neo-Nazi murdered one of us, but Redneck Revolt was there to offer protection, and the fascists steered clear of that park because of it. This is me talking. I've never heard of Redneck Revolt. Seems like Rachel Maddow would have gotten a hold of that story, right? Right? Yeah. I don't think Rachel wants us to know about Redneck Revolt. Anti-fascist, anti-racist militia. The times, they are a-changin'. In Stone Mountain, Georgia, when a group of us marched through the streets to celebrate the cancellation of a Klan rally on February 2nd, we were accompanied by local activists with rifles and ARs slung over their shoulders. The police kept their distance, which was an extraordinary sight for someone used to New York City's ultra-aggressive, hyper-militarized New York Police Department. As the black militant liberation group, the Black Panthers, showed back in the 1960s, as the Zapatistas showed in the 90s, and as anarchists in New Orleans showed during the aftermath of Katrina, when cops and other fascists see that they're not the only ones packing, the balance of power shifts, and they tend to reconsider their tactics. To be honest, the thought of a world in which the state and their running dogs are the only entities with access to firearms sends a shudder down my spine. Leftist gun ownership is about protecting marginalized communities. Not everyone should have access to guns. Domestic abusers, for example, have proven by their actions that they cannot be trusted with that kind of responsibility, and not everyone needs it. No one without a significant amount of training should be handling a firearm at all, which is why I think designated community patrols made up of well-trained, highly trusted individuals who are chosen by and held accountable to said community and who do not hold any more or less power than anyone else due to their position is a far better and more equitable defense model than messy, everyone gets a gun rhetoric. I'm also not interested in creating a parallel cultural universe wherein balaclava-clad gun bunnies pose for the gram. I'd much rather shore up support for Rojava's all-women YPG Women's Defense Unit. I'm interested in reclaiming the notion of armed self-defense from those who have long used it as a cudgel to repress dissent and terrorize marginalized communities, and emphasizing its potential as a transformative tool toward collective liberation. There is a long history of leftist gun ownership and a concurrent theme of state repression against it. As author and anarchist Scott Crow notes, our current gun control laws disproportionately hobble poor communities and communities of color. As far as the state is concerned, black people were never meant to own guns at all. The Second Amendment was intended in part as a means of controlling the enslaved black population and suppressing possible uprisings. And if you're a regular follower of this show, you know that's true. That sentiment has proven to have quite a bit of staying power. In 1967, the Black Panthers staged an armed demonstration on the steps of the California State Courthouse and launched an occupation in protest of the Mulford Act, which banned open carry in the state. Said law was written by a Republican assembly member in response to the Panthers' cop-watching police patrols. Shortly after the protest, state legislators rushed to enact tougher gun control laws with the full support of Republican President Ronald Reagan and the National Rifle Association. I didn't know that. In a stark contrast to its current bloodthirsty propagandizing, the NRA was once a firm proponent of gun control and was a key component of the passage of 1934's National Firearms Act, which imposed restrictions on machine guns. That began to change in the 1960s. The NRA continued to support gun control, but its members, who had been buying guns more for protection than for hunting, started to protest. The shift crystallized in 1977 with the ascent of Harlan Carter, a former immigration agent who'd killed a Mexican teenager in his youth and went on to shape what still fraudulently insists on referring to itself as the oldest civil rights organization in the country in his racist image. Now the NRA's insistence that it fights for the civil rights of legal gun owners rings hollow. Lest we forget, Philando Castile, a legal gun owner, was still killed by cops inches from his partner and child. He'd informed them that he was carrying, and it proved to be a death sentence. With that, as well as the endless extrajudicial killings of black people by cops in this country in mind, some may wonder how anyone can responsibly suggest that more guns are the answer. I defer to the work of groups like the Huey P. Newton Gun Club, the now-defunct Black Women's Defense League, who approached the issue through a black feminist lens, and Denver's Brothers Against Racist Cops, BARC, who framed gun ownership as a civil rights issue and emphasized the need to protect their communities from those who wish them harm. As Black Women's Defense League organizer Nisi X told Vice in 2017, at the end of the day, we have a common goal, and that common goal is ultimately liberation. But at the very least, the well-being and safety of our sisters. We can't depend on the police to protect us. Marginalized communities know best how to keep themselves safe. Depending on law enforcement to protect them from racist and fascist attacks is a losing strategy, especially considering how often that particular call is coming from inside the house. That link goes to the root, report hundreds of police officers belong to racist Facebook groups. The problem is guns. Bullets come from guns, BARC founder Eric Randall told The Guardian in 2016, but the main problem is who is holding the damn gun. No one had a problem with people killing us until we started arming ourselves. I don't have all the answers, but the bare fact of the matter here is that violent right-wing extremism is a continuing threat that has been allowed to spread unabated in this country, a country that is itself rooted in the oppression of people of color. The police will not protect us, neither will the military, or well-meaning liberals, or your favorite oh-so-progressive politicians. It is not in their interest to do so, and recognizing that is imperative to the survival of those who reject this vile status quo. The way that leftists engage with the subject of firearms, conflict, and power within our own communities needs to shift toward a place where guns are considered just another tool in our struggle for collective liberation, not the sole focus. Until we live in a world with no police, no military, and no state, we're at the mercy of all three. And I, at least, don't think it's fair to expect us to confront them empty-handed. Kim Kelly is a freelance writer and labor organizer whose writing on labor, politics, and culture has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Guardian, the New Republic, Teen Vogue, the Pacific Standard, and many other publications. And now we turn to an article by Ryan Nearing, "I Bought a Gun Because I'm Terrified of What Will Happen After Election Day. Fear won, and I can no longer afford to hold on to my anti-gun ideals." So the first article was written by someone who grew up with guns and was pro-gun all along, and this article is written by more of a typical lib. What makes this white liberal atypical is that he married a black woman and has black children. And he lives out in the country. There is no such thing as paranoia. Your worst fears can come true at any moment. Hunter S. Thompson. There's nothing fancy about it, but it'll kill if I ask it to, which I suppose is the defining characteristic of a gun. In that sense, it's perfect. If the shots are well placed, it can kill 18 times before it asks for any assistance in continuing. Ruthlessly efficient and rightfully terrifying, it represents protection in the most dangerous way possible. I hate that I had to buy it, but my fear of what could be coming won out over my ideals. A year ago, I wrote an article about my struggle over buying a gun. The decision to buy a gun is not one I'd have made if I still lived alone. More accurately, it's a decision I wouldn't have had to consider. As a white man in the United States in the year 2020, I face no more threats than I did in 2019, 2009, or at any other point in my privilege-filled life. But I don't live alone anymore. In 2017, I married an amazing, brilliant black woman and became a stepfather to four equally amazing and brilliant black children. As a lifelong radical leftist who grew up in predominantly black spaces with predominantly black friends, I thought I had a grasp on my privilege and their struggles. But I soon learned that hubris is not solely the province of the bigoted and the powerful. The day-to-day reality of being black in the United States is simply beyond the capacity of white people's comprehension. The constant, unrelenting pressure and subtext involved in every human interaction are exhausting in ways we'll never have to feel. The ever-present threats to their physical safety are real, and I understand only enough to know I'll never truly understand. What I do understand with every fiber of my being is that I have to protect my family in every way physically possible, and today, that means owning a gun. My wife and I aren't alone in these fears. As Newsweek has reported, first-time gun ownership in Michigan is skyrocketing, particularly among black Michiganders. Michigan has a deep-seated history of KKK extremism. That history once seemed like a dark relic of our past, but in today's climate, it feels more like a monster that's been lying in wait. My oldest son today is the same age Tamir Rice was when police murdered him in Cleveland for playing with a toy. Unlike Tamir, my son is now 6'3" and 150 pounds. From 10 feet away, he looks every bit like an adult man, which means to the police and racist white folks, he's an even bigger threat. He's a sweet, shockingly perceptive, objectively hilarious kid, and they'd kill him without a second thought. They wouldn't care that he loves anime, Brother Ali, and tacos. They'd only see a large, scary black man. I can teach him how to interact with police and pray he never has to, but the ever-growing threat of emboldened racists and neo-Nazis is a different story. We live in Michigan, a state known for its Great Lakes, automobile manufacturing, and some of the most racist, well-established militias in this country's entire history. The Michigan militia is not a bunch of weekend warrior pretenders cosplaying as tough guys. Past accomplishments include hosting the Oklahoma City Bombers at their meetings. It is the prototype against which many other groups grade themselves, and Michigan is home to many of its spin-offs, including the paramilitary militia behind the very recent plot to kidnap and execute our governor, Gretchen Whitmer. I've lived in Michigan most of my life, and the brazenness of these groups has risen to a level I never thought possible. A year and a half ago, my wife and I bought a 5-acre farm in the country to give our kids space to grow and learn. We practice permaculture and livestock raising as we work toward becoming fully self-reliant. It's beautiful. It's also located squarely in white Trump country. To say our new neighbors gave us a chilly welcome would be an understatement. In fact, on one occasion, I had to physically walk an irate neighbor off our property while he threatened to shoot my dog who'd gotten loose. He went to his car to show me the gun he planned to use and screamed red-faced about how they'd never had to deal with this kind of stuff before. Something another neighbor confirmed was a lie, as their dog gets out all the time. The only difference, it would seem, was that their family is fully white. Against these backdrops, my fears began to mount. The idea of angry, violent white people feeling entitled to come onto our property and threaten our home was no longer theoretical. It had happened, and all it took was our overactive and comically nonviolent black lab running down our street. Now, I want to take issue with this obviously stupid sentence that follows. Donald Trump has created a world. That's all you need to know. It's a stupid sentence right there. Yes, Donald Trump is an asshole, but all he did was fan the flames that were already smoldering. If you didn't feel the need to buy a gun before Donald Trump, you simply weren't paying attention, especially if you live in Michigan, in the country. But I digress. Donald Trump has created a world where these types of entitled, rage-filled white men no longer feel restricted by potential ramifications. Indeed, there almost never are any. My whiteness, although often temporarily confusing to these types, cannot protect my family from the wrath of unhinged and unpoliced white anger and hatred. But this pistol can. I am under no illusions that I'll ever become some sort of righteous Rambo gunning down throngs of hooded Klansmen as they march down our road, but I will no longer be unprepared when violence arrives at my door. We've taken numerous other safety precautions around our property, and although I'm angry we've had to do it, I do believe we are safer now than before. The anti-gun idealist who screamed about tossing the Second Amendment out the window still lives inside me, the same way I suppose a God-fearing Christian boy does, as a chapter in my history before I knew what I now know, a snapshot of a person in a time where privilege and opportunity afforded me space to wax philosophical and academic about things that never actually threatened me. It hurts to compromise or lose an ideal. It feels like the worst parts of the world won out, like there's no hero in your story after all. It feels like a villain somewhere is chuckling in victory, like your vaunted principles were just naivete the whole time. But while all of these feelings are real, they're also all about ego, about my need to feel right and righteous. What I've come to learn is that protecting my family is far more important than protecting my ego. I don't know what the world will look like on the morning of November 4th or in the weeks that follow. By all indications right now, it looks like Joe Biden will win relatively easily. That should bring me a sense of calm and peace. I should be excited that it looks like this country is rejecting the violent, hate-fueled, racist, xenophobic rhetoric of the current administration. You gotta be kidding me. That was me, if you couldn't tell. Instead, I'm worried. I worry about where our neighbors' rage and frustration will go once their leader is no longer our leader. In what ways will the humiliation and anger of a loss manifest, and how dangerous will those manifestations be? I worry that an isolated black family with relatively well-known radical parents in a mostly white area could look a whole lot like a target. On the flip side, should the unthinkable happen again and Donald Trump is reelected, what will the reinforcement of their ideology mean for our family? How much more emboldened will these racists become, and how much more dangerous will it be every time my family goes out together? Perhaps most dangerous of all is the potential for post-election unknowns and the power grabs that could ensue. What happens if Trump loses and simply won't leave or declares victory under the guise of his favorite straw man, voter fraud? Savage and uncontrollable reactions thrive in times of uncertainty, And the United States has a very particular relationship with self-righteous violence against perceived infringements on liberty. This is me talking. I think we need more of that self-righteous violence on the side of the left. Back to the story. I don't have any answers to these questions, only fear. I'm not proud of my fear, but I'm not ashamed of it either. I believe it to be warranted and powerful and deserving of consideration in how we prepare for this future, however it comes to us. My only real answer is to prepare as best I can, and that preparation for my family now sadly includes gun ownership. I have to say about fear, I don't think fear is the same thing as prudence. I don't want to see a fearful gun owner, and I don't want to be a fearful gun owner. A prudent gun owner, on the other hand, is okay. So I take exception to this last paragraph's beginning. So yes, fear won, but fear can be useful. I don't think fear is useful, but I think prudence is useful. I sincerely hope I never have to take that gun out of its lockbox, and that this time in our country's history will someday be remembered as the moment when we all started to really acknowledge and build beyond our racist history. I truly hope I wasted every penny I spent on it and the bullets and safe to secure it. But as of now, I'm ready for whatever may come. Idealism be damned. So, dear viewers and listeners, if Frederick Douglass was right about power conceding nothing without demand, then you have to admit that an armed populace is one powerful way to make a demand. But if we're all armed, we have to understand who the real enemy is. And at this point in history, we obviously don't. So I conclude with this. Far more important than a populace armed with guns is a populace armed with information. So the true fight is to get out and around the mainstream media embargo, the mainstream media funded by the oligarchs embargo, and get true information out to people. The internet is still free enough that we can fight back. So please do your part to spread this kind of information far and wide.